So next in chapter 4, vigilance in the thought of enlightenment, or conscientiousness, or vigilance regarding the awakening mind. You have a kind of intermediary between the Bodhisattva vow and its aspirational sense and the establishment aspects through the six perfections. So it's arisen, and you have to sort of strive with vigilance to maintain it. It's a kind of pep talk on kind of not letting that wonderful experience, so rare, like a lightning flash on a dark night, it's arisen even within me, you know, how to kind of develop, manifest, maintain. You've made a promise through the Bodhisattva vow, and you need to keep your promise. There's a whole kind of array of persuasions in this chapter as to how to encourage you to keep your promise, maintain the Bodhisattva vow. And very strongly in this chapter is this mental quality of apramada, vigilance, which is the opposite of pramada, heedlessness, lack of awareness, intoxication, or negligence. So without that kind of vigilance or heedfulness, as we know, with any kind of good quality, you know, without kind of maintaining and developing it, you know, it can fall away until it's, you know, completely established by irreversibility. So it's the beginning of the establishment aspect of the bodhicitta, this chapter. So you've made a big promise, huge promise. Yeah, how do you keep it? And I suppose is that the idea there's no standing still in the spiritual life. If you're not in some way working to develop and maintain, then maybe you're falling back. How do you feel about that? Do you think that's true? So yes, you need perseverance and constant practice. And again, he does this with reflections on impermanence and death. It's a pep talk, isn't it? So again, you have to think, well, does it work for us as a pep talk? Do the persuasions that he uses work for us, appeal for us? There is a sense, isn't it, that if you you take the Bodhisattva vow and you go back on it, it's very, very bad. It's a bad thing. You know, all those Bodhisattva precepts start, and it's a bad thing to so on, because you've made this vow for the sake of all sentient beings. And I suppose in a more formal kind of situation, you may have taken that Bodhisattva vow and the Bodhisattva precepts in a ritual with your preceptor, with your Bodhisattva preceptor. So you've done something very important. So he's trying to say, it's, you know, it's very ethically, spiritually not good to go back on something. So you've got the whole kind of question, haven't you, about resolve, making a decision, making a commitment, what that means, knowing yourself well enough to make a commitment, what effect does that have if you don't keep your word, I suppose. And you can kind of look at that, can't you, not just in terms of the Bodhisattva vow, which is perhaps the biggest commitment you could ever make, but in other situations in your spiritual life on the way to that, taking vows, taking a precept. So yeah, there's a lot of things, and we could talk about in there. I suppose he's again in this context of the whole of cyclic existence and falling into hell, as it were. Does it say in this chapter that you fall into the Avicii hell? So sorry? He does. You hate it, yes. So that's interesting, isn't it? Well, what would that mean? What would it mean, if we try and rethink that, the Bodhisattva, if the Bodhisattva vow and the Bodhicitta, if it has, meaning for us, and, we really want to develop that, how do we feel? How do we feel when we go against that? How does it feel now in this modern world, when we don't think about the Avicii hell? What's the kind of, what's the connection for us, I suppose? We would feel something, wouldn't we? If I lose my temper, you know, I'll feel wretched after that. You know, so you're trying to kind of, so there's a kind of balance, isn't there, with something that's such a big ideal, both for ourselves and for others. If it's pitched too high, we'll fall into despondency. We won't kind of give up. If it's pitched too low, you know, if we make it all too easy for ourselves, you know, does that motivate us to work towards that ideal? So that, I think we're working with that kind of tension, aren't we, in ourselves and in with others and in the kind of society, situation, mindsets that we live amongst. Yes, so yes, he gives us a strong pep talk and it might not work for us. It's interesting, I think, Dada Rinpoche say to somebody, without the perspective of hell, why would you practice? You know, which obviously for him was completely meaningful because that's the tradition in which he was kind of studied, raised, as it were. But it,
Which is
quite interesting. Yeah. It's so different from my own perspective. Right. I suppose Shantideva has both, isn't he? Because he does practice within the context of karma and rebirth over lifetimes, but he's also saying, you know, now's the moment, now's the time. He manages to not fall into one or the other, you know, to do both. Yeah, so in a way, I suppose we have to ask, well, what motivates us? What keeps us going? What stops us from falling back? What, it may not be fear of hell. And, you know, we know there's a tradition in Buddhism of, you know, incredibly extensive descriptions of hell. You know, I don't know how many there are, 16, 32, there's hot ones and cold ones. And it's very like, we were saying the other day, weren't we? It's very like Dante's Inferno. Because it was a program on the Radio 4, the wonderful Radio 4, Mervyn Bragg talking about Dante's Inferno, about, you know, about the circles of hell and so on. And, you know, so that was a medieval worldview, wasn't it? Very kind of strongly held. And we just don't, we can sort of look at it, but, and we can sort of see in it, I mean, that's a work of poetry as well, isn't it? We can see how the punishment kind of fits the crime, as it were, in the circles of hell, and in the kind of Buddhist hells, you know, the punishment fits the crime. But it's just not, you know, not how we think. If we do something wrong, we don't think I'm going to fall into the Avicii hell. Maybe we should, I don't know. Anyway, these sort of things are going to come up, aren't they, in your discussion group. Yeah, okay, Avicii hell. Avicii hell is the deepest hell, isn't it? I think it's a particularly nasty one. Yeah, so we're in kind of vigilance, apramada, not letting things degenerate, constant practice, perseverance. And also there's a section in here about the kleshas, isn't there? How, you know, that's what we have to be vigilant against. It's the kleshas, it's the poisons. He talks about being hypnotized by the kleshas, falling into a kind of insanity of the kleshas, falling under their power, and, you know, that they will pull us away, as it were, from our commitment to the bodhicitta. They use you like a slave. So yes, he gives us ways of working with the kleshas, and it's interesting to think, well, how do we feel about that? Well, because he expresses a heroic idea that you do battle with your kleshas, you fight them, you fight fire with fire, as it were, you know, you rather than hate, you hate the hatred. Does that work for us? You know, we've got different methods of working with kleshas, you know, in our kind of armoury of practice, as it were. We've got, you know, the ways of working with the hindrances, haven't we, of creating, you know, developing the antidote, considering the consequences, just sky-like attitude, forcible suppression, going for refuge. We've got that kind of armoury, different ways of working with the hindrances. So it's just interesting to look at this, you know, how, what do we think about the heroic ideal, in the way Shantideva expresses heroic ideal? Do we respond to that? Do we think of the Bodhisattva as the hero or not, or what? You know, heroic ideal is not very kind of... again, it's not a kind of particularly current ideal in modern society, is it? It was. Oh, we've got superheroes, haven't we, on movies? Maybe we do. But they've got superpowers, haven't they? We don't think of... Yes, the flawed hero. Yeah.
But you know, it's quite interesting. It's kind of mentally unbalanced in some
way. I said in history, in the past, we've had the sort of the hero in history, and not that they weren't flawed, but you know, perhaps more now we see the flaws, and that's why that's reflected in our modern comic superheroes. Yeah. And as women, you know, do we respond to heroic ideal? Is it a more masculine ideal? There's all sorts of questions which will arise in your study. And I suppose there's, you know, there's a whole development in the movement, isn't there, of pure awareness practice. I don't know what it's called now, it gets called different things, but that, you know, that kind of practice, open awareness, sitting with what happens. You know, you're not doing anything with your hindrances, you're just letting them be there and, you know, fade away, dissolve into the background of mind. So, is there still a place for other ways of dealing with hindrances? Why does Shantideva kind of deal with the hindrances in this way? What's his perspective? Well, his perspective is, isn't it? They're going to steal all your virtue. You know, they're going to take you away from the awakening mind. So you need to deal with them. And that's also reflected in the 7-point mind training, isn't there? There's a verse, you know, in the 8 verses, whenever an unskillful... unskillful state of mind arises, I can't remember the verse completely, whenever an unskillful state of mind arises, I will look into it immediately and deal with it. You know, it's kind of that sort of approach. So do we do that, or do we, you know, we all into just sitting in sky-like attitude? Very interestingly, Bhante, when he was studying with us at Tiruvannamalai earlier this year, on some verses of the Ratnaguna Samchayagatha, he stressed a couple of times, I meant to look back at my notes, but I forgot. He stressed a couple of times that one needs all those methods. And he went back to it again, and I remember thinking, what is he going about this? You know, we know all that about how to deal with hindrances, but he was obviously kind of trying to say something about, well, yes, the sky-like attitude is fine, but it's one of a series of methods for dealing with hindrances. And maybe, you know, sky-like attitude is not enough on its own, and sometimes you need recourse to other methods. So he was kind of giving us a teaching. So questions there about how to deal with hindrances, how to deal with those kleshas which are going to take you away from the awakening mind.